This is A Lost Plot, the podcast where we explore meaning in movies together. Hello, universe. Welcome back. It is your boy with another episode of A Lost Plot. As always, it's me, Maverick, here with a wonderful guest today. We are bringing on Philip St. Jean to talk to us about a very legendary story. Philip, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Of course. Now, you all, if you clicked on this podcast, you know what we're about to talk about. So we're just going to get right into it. Today, we are talking about The Lord of the Rings, The Return of the King. The last in the series of The Lord of the Rings. It has a screenplay, by Fran Walsh, Philippa Boyens, and Peter Jackson. It is directed by Peter Jackson, and it's based on the work by J.R.R. Tolkien of the same name. It's got Elijah Wood as Frodo Baggins, Ian McKellen as Gandalf, Viggo Mortensen as Aragorn, Sean Austin as Samwise Gamgee. It has a whole cast that everyone knows, everyone loves, especially if you've even remotely been familiar with this series. There's a lot of fans of the books, a lot of fans of the movies, and we're going to break that down today. Is it good? Is it not? Is it whack? We'll see. But yeah, before we get into it, of course, Philip, what is The Lord of the Rings, The Return of the King about?
Well, The Return of the King is the culmination in both the books and the movies of the Fellowship and the Two Towers. You've got Aragorn, who's coming into his own as, you know, Elessar, the king of Gondor, and you've got his journey as he takes Gimli and Legolas and the Rohirrim towards Gondor to save them ultimately and to come to battle with Sauron. And then you've got a simultaneous story of Sam and Frodo's journey to Mount Doom with the Ring. Right. And that stays pretty true to both the book and the movie. So, you know, most people know it really well, and there's a lot that goes into both those elements, but that's the basic story.
Yeah, that's pretty good. So out of the 9-point system that we use here to rate the movies that we bring on the podcast, Philip, what did you give The Lord of the Rings, The Return of the King?
Yeah, I can't remember exactly what I gave it, but it was a little low, mainly because I have, and I'm going to take kind of the devil's advocate approach to this. Mm. I think that my comparison is going to be based really heavily on the books. Mm-hmm. And because I grew up with the books first and didn't see the movies until much later, I have an attachment to the books, and I'm going to be fighting pretty hard for them. But I do want to just say from the outset, the music is incredible. The cinematography is really, really great. You get these incredible wide shots that really give it a sense of the scope and the size of the armies and Minas Tirith and the Rohirrim in the battlefields. And it's these epic shots, I think, are really what makes the movie so memorable. So you don't see scope like that often. Mm-hmm. And it's done really, really well. But I think that the narrative and a lot of the tension throughout the movie has some serious problems, especially when compared to books. So that's where I'm coming from.
I am genuinely excited for this because it's definitely not where I come from for this movie. I gave it a solid 8.3, which if you've been following the podcast at all, that's pretty high for me. Granted, I'm like the extended edition listen, watcher, viewer type guy. So, you know, putting in the 5 hours that it takes to watch the full movie is definitely, I think, says something about my personal enjoyment of it. But I don't think it's without fault. Obviously, it didn't get a perfect score. It would be very hard for a movie to get a perfect score for me. But that's pretty high up there. That's up there with Gladiator. That's up there with other ones. And we'll see if Philip can change my mind. So anyways, there is an opening scene here where you have Sméagol and the introduction of him as a character earlier on in his narrative life. And then after that, it reintroduces Frodo and Sam, and then also Aragorn and the rest of the troop at Saruman's place. Why can't I think of it right now?
Isengard,
that's right. So that's pretty much the opening gist for all of the characters. What did you think about that opening arc?
Yeah, so in terms of how much it grabs you, I mean, they go hard. You know, you've got Smeagol and Deagle in the boat, and I made a joke right off the bat because Deagle gets pulled into the water, and that part of the CGI did not age very well. I'm very impressed.
The fish, like, down there, yes,
it's not great, but yeah. I gotta say, I'm very impressed with the rest of the CGI and the practical effects. Mm-hmm. Really well done, has aged very well, but that one part was just kind of funny. But it really grabs you right off the bat with this. You know, you get this kind of interesting discovery of the ring, and he pulls it up, and this is a story that, you know, has already been told previously, but you get this reenactment of it in the extended edition. It goes on, and Smeagol murders Deagol, which mm-hmm. is exactly what happens, and it's a little rough to see. And you get, you know, Smeagol's progression into Gollum as he, you know, is eating fish, and he's kind of gets a little disgusting, but very Peter Jackson-y. And then you get this switch into, okay, now we're back. And it was honestly a little bit interesting to me because it doesn't start with the Return of the King. The book does. It starts kind of back in the Two Towers. But that makes some sense to me because the Return of the King as a book, it was, you know, the Lord of the Rings was originally set up as just one long book, and they kind of just chopped it up into three. So narratively, they're going to have to start where it makes sense to start. So mm-hmm. I think they did a good job of, like, grabbing your attention, drawing you into the movie. And it was like, okay, here we are. We've just defeated, you know, you got past the cliffhanger at the end of the last movie. Right. And now we're starting right off where we ended.
Yeah. And when you're thinking of specifically where they chopped it up a little bit differently, are you thinking of that in regards to Frodo and Sam? Are you thinking about that in regards to Aragorn? Or is that in regards to just every one of those scenes?
Yeah, it's both. In The Return of the King, it starts with Sam rescuing Frodo from after Shelob has already gotten him and he has to pull him out of the tower. It's a little jarring when you start The Return of the King, because it's like, okay, you know, we stopped last book after Sam had discovered Frodo was still alive.
Hmm.
And you had to wait, you had to go read the second, you had to go read the third book before you find out what happens to Frodo. Whereas in this one, they're not even on the path past Minas Morgul at that point. Yeah. So it's cut a little differently. And I actually kind of appreciated that because it's a little less jarring. It makes for a better kind of entry into the story.
Yeah, well, especially because Shelob's lair is, in my mind, an iconic scene in The Return of the King, partially because of just how dark, and also, frankly, because it's a massive spider, and massive spiders are disgusting, so that's going to stick out in your mind, especially when you're 12 and watching this for the first time. So, that's interesting. I didn't realize that. It's been a while since I've read the books. So I recently read Fellowship, but I need to go back and reread The Two Towers and The Return of the King. But of course, that's why you're here to correct me on those things.
Yeah, it's when you read the book and immediately watch the movie, you notice that, but I don't think you notice otherwise.
That's funny. So the opener for me, I thought, was one of the most solid openers I've seen. There's a couple other openers in movies that I think are very good. But this opener particularly did a couple of really great things. One, it started off with some solid reintroduction of characters, right? Who they are, what they're doing, why they're there, right? It also showed some of the things that are at stake, right? And I think I'm really curious to get your take, especially on the Isengard scene, because that's very different from what actually happens in the books, I know. But in my mind, that was one of the things that they changed, that they used to their advantage in regards to telling the narrative. And I'll get into that in a second. But then especially Frodo showing, okay, the weight of the ring at this point, how much it's weighing down on him, and Smeagol, how quickly the ring corrupted him. Which was interesting, especially because some of the people in the YouTube comments had a little bit of a discussion with us on what the corruption of Frodo versus Smeagol and how quickly it corrupted Smeagol is a very interesting aspect to how powerful the ring is, how much of a desperate entity it is in itself in regards to affecting other people. So yeah, and if you're listening and you want to interact with us, we try to interact on all the channels, like and subscribe, all that crap, you know, or I'm not here to plug it too hard, but you know what you're at when you're on this. So anyways, what were your thoughts on Isengard specifically? Because that is, like I said, very different from the books.
Yeah, it starts out very similarly. You know, you've got Theoden, Legolas, Gimli, Aragorn, and Gandalf are all there. Mm-hmm. Sauron's in his tower. They have a discussion with Treebeard about, you know, you see that Isengard is wasted. It's a lake now. And you've got Grima and Saruman up in the tower. And Saruman is essentially trying to talk his way out. Trying to get Theoden to give him what he wants. And
is what you're explaining right now, are you explaining it from the movie's perspective or from the book's perspective?
These are the similarities between the movie and the book. They progress very similarly. They use a lot of the same language as well. It's almost word for word exactly the same. Theoden's conversation with Sauron. So that part, I started thinking, oh, okay, so this is going to progress very similarly. And I have not seen the extended edition before, so I was watching that for the first time.
Yeah.
And I believe this is an added scene. But that's where the similarities end. And you get, I, of course, having read the books, you know, you don't have the narrator explaining, like, the voice of Saruman and how oily and how much it gets into the heads of these people. Mm-hmm. How they think he's going to get away with it. Théoden's going to let him out and they're all going to be enslaved. And obviously that's not necessarily something you can do in the movie. You can't really portray that. You don't have a narrator explaining it. So I get why you wouldn't necessarily want to continue that scene for a really long time, because it just doesn't have the impact it has when you have a narrator explaining. But I think I understand why they got rid of Saruman right there and then. You know, Grima stabs him. Legolas shoots Grima. That's the end of that. Tied up in a nice little bow. That enemy's over. So narratively, if you're thinking about these movies as like individual movies, and I think that that's really, if I were going to approach these movies as, if I were going to approach these movies from whatever the script writers were doing, I think that's what they were thinking, was we need to make each of these movies stand alone. And so you've got the main conflict in the two towers is Saruman. It's not really Sauron yet. And then you get to the second, you get to the third movie and it's like, okay, now we're looking at Sauron. So Saruman's got to go. We can't be thinking about Saruman anymore. Whereas in the books you get this, there is this further purpose for him. And I think this is where you see really the big first difference for me, which is Tolkien's telling you an epic. The Lord of the Rings as a series is an epic that Tolkien is crafting that has this mythology and this feeling of grandness and scope and scale. And Peter Jackson is showing you a movie. And it's a standalone movie. And so I gotta say, I don't love what they did there. You know, he kills Grima and he throws him off the Grima kills Saruman, throws him off the tower, and you get this gratuitous scene where Saruman gets impaled on a stake and then floats underwater. And it's like, I get it. It's a little satisfying. It's, hoisted by your own petard kind of thing. Right. But simultaneously, it means that you're not going to have this coming of age for these hobbits later down the road, which you get in the books. And it immediately takes that away. And so I'm thinking, oh no, what are we going to see later on with this now? So that scene was a little interesting to me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I love that you added that bit at the end, because if anyone's read the books, you know that in the actual books, the Saruman does not die in this part of the movie. He ends up going to take over the Shire and do a whole bunch of havoc there in the books, and that all gets cut out in the movies. Instead, you see him die right here and then. So it is interesting to think about, okay, there is a coming of age for all of the hobbits in the books that you don't get through this telling of the story, which is interesting because and I'm sure maybe we might get to this. I don't know how much I'm going to emphasize the very, very end, except for that the very end is long in regards to an outro, but you do get a very different take on the hobbits at the end of the book, or sorry, the end of the movie, where they all are, all of our main characters are disjointed in some ways, where they don't have, they're talking to people who have no reference point at all for what they've gone through. And I think there's a sense in which having Saruman at the end cause this coming of age, more or less, for the characters could have provided more of a reference point where this home that they've returned to has matured as well, not just the characters. Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah, that's interesting. I haven't really thought about that. And maybe we'll talk about that more, but... yeah, the opener in regards to Saruman, I do think I agree with you that it ties a neat bow. And what's, because as you were saying it, right, especially because there's different things that open up the Two Towers versus the Return of the King, let's just say, since they're kind of cutting this up a little bit more conveniently for the sake of their narrative, is there a reason that they didn't just kill Saruman at the end of the last book? Or at the end of the last movie, excuse me. And I think that there is actually reason for having him at the beginning of this one. And the reason is because that dialogue that you were talking about that they have at the beginning of this scene, where you have Aragorn, you have Theoden, and you have all of these other characters interacting with Saruman. And Saruman has a very... all of these conversations, more or less, go around him saying, you guys are going to die, even if, like, whatever happens to me, like, Theoden, you failed as a king. Aragorn, you really are not going to become the next king of Gondor. Like, all of this stuff is, like, you guys are done for. And that sets the tone, I think, for the rest of the movie. Where there's a lot of people who are saying, this isn't going to work. And in regards to Aragorn's arc, you are going to... you should sit in despair, more or less, because this isn't going to work out. You're not going to save your people. So I think in regards to thematically setting the mood for how everything is going to go going forward, they implemented Saruman very well for the purpose of that.
Right. In constructing their narrative for the movie and again, standalone, I think is how I have to look at that, is like, it needs to make sense isolated from the other movie, to some extent at least. And then getting that, the Palantir, of course, is an important part of that, both the book and the movie. And of course, it just falls in different ways. You know, Grima throws it out of a window in the book, and Saruman just drops it because he gets stabbed in the movie. And either way, Pippin picks it up. And that kind of galvanizes the next action of like, okay, Pippin needs to end up in Gondor.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And it is interesting, too, to think of the epic aspect of this. I don't know exactly how to ask this question, but what I'm thinking is you clearly have a mindset of the grand epic narrative that Tolkien was trying to tell, right? Where he was building this mythology in a way that is different from, say, telling a narrative tale. How do you think... As obviously a fan, how do you think that the, more or less I'm trying to get at, there's obviously a purpose behind telling an epic versus telling a standalone story. What do you think are the benefits and drawbacks of telling it in an epic format compared to telling it in this narrative form that we see in this movie?
Yeah, this is actually something my buddy, who I was watching it with last night, kind of pointed out, which is, I think one of the biggest differences between the books and the movies is, and one of the things, one of my biggest gripes with the movie is their treatment of the hobbits. The hobbits in Jackson's version are really more comedic relief than anything else. Sam and Frodo are kind of, you know, they're important, but, you know, their relationship's messy in the movies, and it's very human, and by that I mean man, so not hobbit. Whereas, like, in the epic version, the hobbits are the main characters, really. You can, I think you could really just take Merry, Pippin, Sam, and Frodo and say, this is the main character, because they're showing up in every single scene, almost. Aragorn is extremely important in the books, obviously, but right. he's the main character in the movies. Aragorn has to have flaws. If he's the main character, he has to have flaws. He has to come to himself. He has to come into his own, which means the movies have to show him as more human than the books do. The books show him as this hero out of an ancient tale, almost. You know, he appears to them just like Gandalf. He appears to the hobbits in The Prancing Pony, and he just never leaves. And he's like basically perfect. And he has, you know, he has some concerns about like, especially after Gandalf dies and he has to, or what Gandalf falls and he has to lead the fellowship. He has some doubts and he has some concerns, but he's not super relatable as a character. I mean, he's 88 when he enters the story, 88 right. years old. He's already established himself as the leader of the Dunedain, and he's got this whole background in history. He knows who he is, and his confidence is, and my friend was telling me about this last night. He's saying, you know, in the books, he swaggers in. He knows who he is. He is a Lessar. The only way he's winning Arwen's hand is by becoming King of Gondor and by defeating the Dark Lord and by taking back his place in the throne. He knows what he's there for. He knows what he's going to do. He's confident in that. But in the movies, you've got somebody who's a lot more kind of riddled with doubts and concerns, and he's much less confident about what he's doing than you can see him in the book. And you have to have that if you're going to have Aragorn as the main character, because otherwise he's not relatable. So I think that that's like one of the key differences in this epic version. You have pre-made characters that come in out of the old tales. Legolas, Gimli, Aragorn, and Gandalf. All these people have their own stories and backgrounds, and they're joining this epic tale, and it's really pushing, propelling the hobbits forward into doing something specific and special. Obviously, the problems with telling a story as an epic in a movie is that Gandalf, super unrelatable. Aragorn, super unrelatable. You can't, like, they're perfect, almost. They're almost perfect. Gandalf is incredibly wise. He's far-seeing, and he knows that there's something special about the hobbits. Aragorn has massive amounts of experience and he knows who he is. He's confident in himself. And even though he may go wrong, he knows what to do next. So obviously that doesn't make for as compelling a story if you're concentrating on those people. If that's what you are trying to tell a story about, you have to switch it up.
So for that situation, right? I really like that feedback, that background. Would you say that, because it almost sounds like to me that the way you put that, and I might be misinterpreting it, but there is some benefit, for a narrative sense at least, to almost make these characters more flawed or give them a different type of personality than they have in the books. Are you saying that? I guess what's your take on that?
Yeah, so I think there can be. Is the fair way to put it. I take issue with the fact that Jackson did it to this book. I think that it deserved something that was going to hold to its truth, because the more you read the book and then you watch the movie, all I could think the whole time was he missed the point. He missed the point of this character completely. And it was, for the most part, it's the hobbits. He truly doesn't understand what the point of the hobbits is. And, you know, if you look at what Christopher Tolkien says, he did not like the movies.
Really?
He says, essentially, if I can remember it correctly, he just, when he was interviewed on the movies, he says, the chasm between the beauty and seriousness of the work and what it has become has overwhelmed me. The commercialization has reduced the aesthetic and philosophical impact of the creation to nothing. There's only one solution for me: to turn my head away. They eviscerated the book by making it an action movie for young people. So, Christopher Tolkien and I'm inclined to agree, because if you don't get this on the first read of the book, you may not even get it on the second. If you've only read the book a couple of times and you read it when you were younger, I would urge you to go back and read it again and just get get the idea for what Tolkien's really trying to do, because it's good. It's good versus evil. But Tolkien wants you to think about what is good. Mm-hmm. And good is hobbits. Good is good, solid, earth-loving hobbits. Men do great things, but men do bad things too. It's not that hobbits can't do bad things. It's just that their simplistic nature and their drive to do the right thing, because it's the right thing, even when it's uncomfortable and even when they're used to and like comfort, it's the thing that keeps... It's the thing that keeps the whole world together, is the fact that Frodo holds off from the ring for so long when no one else would be able to. Only a hobbit could have done that. Mm-hmm. Only a hobbit. Gandalf said he couldn't do it. Aragorn's wise enough to know he couldn't. Boromir mm-hmm. couldn't handle being near the ring. Denethor right. would have taken it in a second. Right. And so the only person of all the great and good and wonderful people, Galadriel, Elrond, none of them would take the ring. None of the wise would take the ring, and the others had to be kept from it. The only one that could mm-hmm. do this job was Frodo, and it's because he's a hobbit. So you miss mm-hmm. that entirely in the movies, and it's a massive part of the book. The philosophical questions and the great good versus evil and the battle within your own self is a huge part of the books, and you just completely miss it. So yeah. that's kind of my take on that.
That's really interesting, because especially the hobbits being the main characters, it is interesting to think about that, especially because as I was watching this time around, I was thinking, okay, there's a couple scenes for sure where Pippin in particular sticks out to me. I could see Merry being justified in some ways for where he was at, but there's especially times where Pippin's in the movie or he's riding with Gandalf, and there's a big question in my mind, why is he even here? Because he's not really adding anything to this scene other than his physical presence. So yep. I do think that if you keep it in the perspective of the hobbits are the main characters, that makes more sense, especially in the grand epic narrative of keeping in mind these two entities. I have heard the idea that this is a grand epic of good versus evil, right? And it's very clear that Sauron is an embodiment of evil in whatever manifestation he can be. But I haven't really thought of the idea of the hobbits being the counter to that. So, and I think it aligns somewhat with what we see in the movie, but not in the same way. So you mentioned that the hobbits are a main characters in the books, and in the movies, it's more of Aragorn. Would you still say that Frodo is a main character in this story? Who would you say the main character is? Or is there multiple? Is there one? What is your take on that?
I think it's definitely fair to say that there are multiple. I would say mm-hmm. that Frodo is absolutely a main character in the movies, but this is where with this review, this 9-point system, this is mm-hmm. where the movie took a hit for me, mm-hmm. is because we're trying to see, okay, is the character flawed in a compelling way? Is there mm-hmm. a reason for what they're doing? And you see that they create this flaw in Aragorn, or they create this tension within him mm-hmm. that needs to be resolved in order to have a satisfying conclusion.
Right.
But I don't think you really see that with Frodo. And I may be holding it against it wrong, because it maybe this is something that continues in from the Two Towers. But for mm-hmm. me, Frodo seems to be exactly the same the entire time. He seems to be just kind of there to deliver the lines and to continue that part of the story on its way. You see a lot mm-hmm. of tension with Sam, which is interesting, right. And I really don't like the way they did that. but you see a lot of tension with Sam, but Frodo is, there's besides his argument with Sam and then them separating their ways, you don't really see many flaws. It's really, really difficult. And I'll give them this. It's very difficult when you're like, your mind is being taken over slowly by an evil object you're carrying. It's right. difficult to show like, well, what's the difference between that and a flaw within the character? But I think that you see, mm-hmm. you don't get as much character development with Frodo as you do with Aragorn. And that kind of shows that, like, yes, Frodo's a main character, and yes, he's important to the story. But Jackson is saying, making an executive decision and saying, that part is important, but we're going to cut some of that stuff and really kind of draw out more of Aragorn's story so that we can make his narrative make more sense. And that's kind of what I think of those two characters.
Right. Well, especially because, and the Two Towers is a little bit, in my opinion, it's the least interesting of the three movies, partially because in many ways it's simply a conduit to the next one, where it's adding, it's extending the storyline, but a lot of these things are setting the groundwork for this movie specifically, right? And that's where I see where you're coming from, where in especially the Two Towers, you see Frodo really get turn as a character from being a I can carry this burden, I am going to Mordor, to feeling the weight of the ring a lot more strongly, and maybe falling more prey to the temptations of the ring than he has previously. And so, I guess, because I did put that he does have these serious flaws, but two of the differences, I think, between how I saw it and what you just said is exactly that. One, you have some of this from the previous movies, right? And so part of this buy-in of, oh, this character is incredibly flawed, is you see this corruption that has occurred throughout three movies versus just a single one. So if you think about this one by itself, it is not as easy to make that argument. But secondarily, too, I see the corruption itself as part of the flaw versus what you just said is that the manifestation of the ring is the real cause of this evil. And it's not necessarily an inherent flaw within Frodo. I'm not sure if I agree that that's not a flaw, just because it is a corruption from an outside source. But I do think that it's important to note that.
For me, if they're going to have, and this is why I keep saying, you know, they're obviously trying to make a movie that kind of stands on its own. Mm-hmm, and
right.
I can take a certain level of like, okay, we don't necessarily need to introduce these characters in the same way we did before,
right?
But you see this, and I'm just going to give an example from a little later. You see this with Gandalf and Pippin. It's like they've never met before. It's this very odd kind of, okay, you have this arc with Gandalf and Pippin. It's kind of subtle, and it's long throughout the entire movie, where Pippin is a fool. He's a fool of a Took. Using the Palantir, stealing it from Gandalf without permission, and then Gandalf later when he's in the tower and he offers a sword to Denethor, and he comes back dressed in the power of the guard gear.
Right.
Gandalf is kind of like, psh, a hobbit as a tower guard? Silly. And it's like, okay, well, Gandalf, have you never met a hobbit before? Aren't you the one that's constantly talking about how surprising they are and good at things they are? Mm-hmm. Don't you know who Pippin is? Haven't you experienced this already with him? Because, I mean, at this point, Pippin has already shown himself to be wily, and he's proved himself by, you know, leaving a trail off in the Two Towers, leaving a trail off the side to allow them to track them better and let them know they're alive. He's shown himself to be more than just a fool. And Gandalf has a short temper, but Gandalf is wise. So he knows that a hobbit is more than they seem. But you have this tension that the movie narrative creates so that you can later see for 30 seconds, Pippin kills an orc and Gandalf goes, good job, I believe in you now. And it's like, okay, you get that nice kind of, we wrap it up with a bow, Pippin's cool. And he's deserving of praise. But they do this with Gandalf. Gandalf already knows who these people are. And the only way that makes any sense at all is if you say, okay, let's kind of put the second movie aside and say, these characters really need to have these tensions in their relationships and learn and grow together in this movie. We can't just rely on the relationships from the second movie to roll into the third. So I think that you've got to do one or the other. You can't piecemeal it up and say, okay, we're going to rely on the old narrative when it's convenient, but we're not going to rely on it when we feel like we can fit it into the narrative.
Okay. I see what you're saying. That's a very nuanced approach. I appreciate that. Because you are right. And I think I was thinking about that too when I saw Pippin, is when he picks up the Palantir and he calls him a fool of a Took, that's hearkening back in some ways to the first movie, right? Where he knocks the bucket down the well and causes all that chaos in the Mines of Moria. and that he calls him a fool if it took then. And so that's in some ways hearkening back, but it's also reestablishing a baseline for how Gandalf sees Pippin. But that is true that when you have that baseline, it helps to show that arc specifically. And that's not the same as maybe showing the arc of Frodo, which I think is what you were trying to get at, is that Frodo doesn't have, you have more borrowed capital from Frodo from previous movies than you do with Pippin in this case, where they reestablish it pretty solidly. I mean, I don't hate that. But it does draw into question, right? Does this movie stand on its own as a legitimate movie, or am I seeing it too much in light of the previous movies, right?
And am I seeing it too much in light of the books? Yeah, that's
it's worth saying, right? Because I think one of my critiques of especially a lot of recent Marvel movies is that there is a lot of this effort to carry borrowed capital from previous movies into the next movie. Right. And I don't think that it works. I don't think that they do it well. And part of that is situations like probably similar, to be honest, with what we're having with Frodo, where you have this character and you establish this baseline of, oh, they're corrupted. And they assume that you've seen this arc before and are going to carry that arc into this movie. Right. Where it's like at the end of the day, I'm watching let's just say Avengers, right? And you're watching Avengers with Ant-Man, and Ant-Man has a whole arc in his own movie, but as an individual character in the Avengers movie, he doesn't have that same value because he doesn't have any arc in that story. So having an individual arc in the movie that they're in is important. We can't deny that. And maybe part of where I'm coming from with this movie specifically is, oh, well, The Lord of the Rings is meant to be watched back to back to back, whereas Marvel is not. I don't think that justifies it, but I do think that there is something to be noted there. That's I do actually think that that's more relevant than I thought it was initially. So that probably will affect my reading. Side characters. What did you think? I think you've talked a little bit about some of them, but do you think that they're motivated by their own motives, desires, needs in this story?
I was a little confused about a lot of the side characters, and I think that's where things really fell apart for me, because I can, I can understand some shifting of the narrative to try and make Aragorn a main character. I don't agree with it and I don't love it, but I understand Aragorn's this really epic character. And if you're Peter Jackson and you're trying to make an action movie that really appeals to younger audiences, little people who are running around who mostly hide, and you know, their entire point is that they're trying to avoid war and everything, is not the way to go. Right. I understand that that's what he was doing. I don't like it. I don't agree with it. I don't think he should have done it to The Lord of the Rings. But if you're trying to do that, I understand crafting a narrative around Aragorn that makes for a little bit more tension and a little bit more of like a, okay, he needs to have some doubt. But when you get to the side characters, things just fall apart. Theoden is... You have this moment where Saruman at the beginning says, why would you help Gondor? Mm-hmm. We are old friends. Help me. And Theoden responds as a king should. And he says, basically, get you gone. You are evil. And he's quite rightly, as he does in the book. Right. And then later you have this weird moment of, I can't remember, I think it might be a messenger rides in and asks for aid for Gondor, or says Gondor aid, or it's Gandalf. Mm-hmm. And Theoden says, why should we help Gondor? Mm-hmm. They didn't help us.
Right.
Where did that come from? What Theoden, as Lord of the Mark, has made a vow, as has all his ancestors, of mutual defense of Gondor and Minas Tirith, because Minas Tirith is the first line of defense and the last thing to fall before evil and darkness sweep over the land.
Right.
Nobody wants Minas Tirith to fall. It's a bad thing. Everybody knows it's going to go poorly for the Rohirrim if Minas Tirith falls, because that's the choke point, and if you lose the choke point, it's over. But so it doesn't make sense strategically for him to have said it. It doesn't make sense, especially in light of, and maybe again, maybe I'm maybe now I'm doing the same thing you were doing, where I'm looking back at the second book and going, well, we already had this tension resolved. Gandalf already came in as, you know, we need to help one another. And here I am with Aragorn, who will be king of Gondor. He's a man of Numenor.
Right.
And he's going to help you fight. And Aragorn does. And Theoden says, we will go to the aid of Gondor.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have the third movie where suddenly he's saying, I don't know about that. And then that's it. He does it anyways. And there's no resolution there. And it didn't make sense to me why that scene was in the movie at all.
Yeah, I think this is another situation where in some ways, I think Theoden and Denethor are in some ways contrasted with each other. And that's part of the point of this movie. So, and once again, I think this point does borrow a bit from the previous movie, where you have the issue of Helm's Deep, and Aragorn in the movies requests that they call for aid from Gondor. And there's this idea of this mutual alliance there. And Theoden basically says, oh, well, Gondor's not going to come. And then he gets mad when Gondor doesn't come, when he doesn't ask for aid, right? And so you have like a situation where that same thing in some ways plays out on the other side with Gondor itself and Denethor. And so I think that that's part of the purpose. I do think that, once again, this is another example where they borrow from the previous movie. And like we said before, it's made to be a trilogy. It's made to be watched back to back in some ways, or at least kept in mind from the previous one. Does it make it a standalone movie? Probably not. But I think that background is a little bit helpful for keeping in mind his arc specifically, because he goes, I think it's trying to demonstrate this character who has some sort of anger and frustration with the whole situation. And part of that is perhaps him saying to everyone else that he's angry with these other people, when in reality he's angry with himself and shamed that he wasn't able to protect the Westfold, right? He wasn't able to really lead his people in the way he felt like he should as the king of Rohan. And so he might be taking it out in these other ways by saying like, oh, well, I'm not going to protect Gondor because I'm going to protect my people. And why does he say that? Because he hasn't been able to protect his people in the past, and he's trying to do what he feels like he's supposed to as a king in protecting his nation. And so that might come at the expense of another nation, and that might be very nearsighted, because obviously if you can't protect Gondor, then you can't actually protect your people, because like you said, that's the choke point. But as a person who's got emotions, who's been really shamed as a leader in the last book, in the last movie, he feels the need to almost shield himself from more harm. Does that make sense? Does that provide a good counter maybe to what you were saying?
You know, that's very interesting. And it makes some of the other lines that Theoden has that, like, I think there's a moment with whether at Meduseld where he's talking to Eowyn, and he's basically, well, Aragorn is really the real leader.
Mm-hmm.
And Eowyn's like, what? And he goes, never mind, it's fine. And he's like being self-deprecating and self-pitying. And that line didn't make any sense to me at the time. But with that background, it kind of makes a little bit more sense that they're trying to have this kind of mirror relationship between Theoden and Denethor, where you have, oh, there's this tension between these two great lords. And again, like, I get it. Now I get it. Because that explanation, that it makes a lot more sense. But in terms of just the whole narrative as the narrative as a whole, there is so much danger and so much at stake. And these are the lords of the West that have these ancient bonds. Theoden knows in the books, Theoden knows that Denethor has his hands full. Denethor literally cannot send anybody to help. Nor can he send anybody in time, because they don't have riders. And that's the big thing.
Right,
Rohan has his horses. So no help will come from Gondor in time. And Gondor can't spare anybody anyways. And Theoden knows that. And there is, I don't think there's any need to add more tension than Sauron will literally enslave and kill all of you. I feel like that's enough. So it's, to me, it's a little interesting that they feel the need to like add these little, oh, you've got this tension between these two characters. And it's like, okay, I get why you did that. And I can see how you're doing it now, but is it really necessary? And does it add anything to the story? And especially in concern with, does it make Théoden make sense as a standalone character in The Return of the King? To me, it's like he seems very fickle and back and forth, and there's no scenes that show him like changing his mind, or there's no like Eowyn goes and speaks to him because of her great love for Aragorn. That would have made more sense, you know. It would have shown that Eowyn actually has these deep feelings for Aragorn, and would have given them an opportunity to like reason to actually go and assist. But they don't have any of that. It's just Théoden, just like when he gets the message, he gets the call from the beacons, he goes, you know what, we will help. I changed my mind. So it's interesting. Okay. I take your meaning though. That changes my perspective a little bit on that. Yeah.
Right. Well, and so I think, and I see that personally, just so for the sake of making sure that we continue this dialogue furthering into the story before getting too bogged down at the beginning, because I really appreciate the beginning. I think it sets the stage for everything else. So we will move on after, but I want to hit 2 points with you. So we might be here for the next 10 minutes. I don't know. But for the sake of Théoden, as a character, I saw that as he was the contrast in that scene to what, why am I forgetting it just now? Denethor does, right? Where he goes, Gondor will, or Rohan will answer, is him doing what he actually knows to be right, even though he has these conflicting emotions, versus Denethor is one who at the end of the day ends up acting far more selfishly and has a lot of his own internal motives, which partially drives how he acts, at least in the movies. So I think that it's an opportunity for him as a king to do what he knows is right, even though internally he has these other things going on that makes him not really. He has conflicting emotions, but at the end of the day, he chooses to do the right thing, I think, is more or less what I'm trying to get at. So, but I do see a little bit where you're saying the confusion is, and maybe it's a little more nuanced. You did mention Eowyn in that section. What were your thoughts of her as a character in this story?
So, sorry, I'm going to address what you said before.
Sure, that's fine. That's fine.
It's important to note that like Denethor is, from the outset, Gandalf says he's crazy, he's lost his mind, which happens in the books, but much later. And so immediately after Gandalf says that, to the audience, at least to my mind, the audience goes, okay, well, he's lost it. So nothing he does for the rest of the movie counts, because he's literally insane. Like, his behavior, and I guess, I mean, technically speaking, who on earth would send your son and the only horseman that you actually have on a death charge towards an army like 10 times the size of yours that you know they're going to get defeated by?
Right.
Versus in the books, where Faramir's actually sent as a captain to Osgiliath to hold the crossing of the river, which they know they will lose, but they need to make the enemy pay so they have time for the Rohirrim to get there. That's a sacrifice that makes sense, a strategy that's solid, and a moment where Denethor says Boromir would have done it. And you get to see this great pain, and Faramir has a good reason to think my father hates me. It's not because he's crazy. His father is crazy in the movie, and it's like he sends his son out to die because he's insane. Okay, he's crazy. No, he has real daddy issues. He's got problems, and he loves his son Boromir too much. And you get this, you get to have these moments in the books where it's like the relationship between father and son and the grief of a father over losing his child. You don't get that so much in the movies, because it's like, okay, we kind of need to wrap this up. We need to figure out how to get Faramir injured and get him back. And like, I get needing to do that. It's important, but you could have done the same thing. You could have, you didn't need to have the scenes with Osgiliath, and you could have had the regret anyways, but that's my issue with the Denethor thing. But
sure.
That being the foil to to Theoden than is, you know, it makes sense right. in the movies. I get it. Uh-huh. I get what they're kind of trying to get at. Eowyn. Sorry, moving on to Eowyn.
Okay, now I have to stop you because I have to.
Okay, yeah, go ahead.
Theoden is too. I mean, Denethor. Sorry, is so much of an interesting character on his own.
Yes.
So the Battle of Pelennor Fields, and this is definitely getting further into the movie, right? And I think that's a good perspective to keep in mind, because in the movies, if I'm understanding correctly, the Battle of Pelennor Fields happens after Osgiliath is taken, versus in the books, it happens before Osgiliath is taken. Is that a correct understanding?
There isn't a Battle of Pelennor Fields in the book, not at least in the same way. So there is, in the books, what happens is there's Osgiliath is being held, has been held by Gondor for the past several years. Mm-hmm. There's a garrison there, and the enemy's coming, and they know the enemy's coming. Gandalf arrives on Shadowfax to let them know the Rohirrim will come.
So to Denethor, Osgiliath?
To Minas Tirith, to let them know the Rohirrim are coming. So they know that they're going to have allies coming, but they're not going to be there for 7 days, something mm-hmm. like that.
Something like
that's
that, yeah.
what Gandalf tells them. And so they then have to go, okay, how long can we hold out? 7 days mm-hmm. is a long time. So you've got the main crossing at Osgiliath, and you know that's where the enemy's going to hit. Denethor mm-hmm. says, I have long known that that is where the enemy will strike, because mm-hmm. he has a Palantir. Denethor, and this is something that bothered me about the movie as well, Denethor is of a high kingly race. He's a Numenorean of pure blood, and he's a descendant of this race of kings. You know, he's mm-hmm. he's a descendant of Elrond's brother. Mm-hmm. Well, it was Elros or Elrohir, I think. Mm-hmm. I might be thinking of his sons. But he has knowledge, and he's farsighted, and he has a Palantir. He mm-hmm. is a very intelligent, very well-bred, very important character. Mm-hmm. And he can see what's going on, but he's losing his mind slowly. He's mm-hmm. not losing it all at once, and he's still got some go in him, but he knows enough that they're going to hit Osgiliath, and that makes total sense in a story that is built around Gondor is the bastion of protection for the rest of the world from Saruman. Mm-hmm. From Sauron. Right. I keep doing that. Right.
That's fine. Yeah.
Which means they have so much experience with strategy, fighting an enemy that's larger than them.
Right.
Fighting at a disadvantage. They know what's going to happen. He has captains that come to him and give him information, and they have councils together. They have councils mm-hmm. with Gandalf. He would never have them just send all the horsemen out onto the field to die. Holding mm-hmm. Osgiliath strategically makes a lot of sense, and it makes for some really nice tension where you have he sends his son out to do this because Boromir took Osgiliath, mm-hmm. and now Faramir's going to lose it, mm-hmm. and his father knows he's going to lose it.
Mm-hmm.
And so you have Osgiliath is taken, predictably, mm-hmm. and then you have Faramir trying to organize the retreat. And mm-hmm. that's when you get the Witch King and the Nazgul come in, and Gandalf has to ride out. And so it's.
And is that when Faramir gets injured?
That's when Faramir's injured on the escape from Osgiliath. And then Faramir's out for the rest of the books. He's mm-hmm. the only times you see him after that is in the Houses of Healing.
Okay.
So it makes much it that strategically makes a lot more sense than mm-hmm. than, you know, having the charge is very cool. Very cool charge. Right. Makes no sense. So
it's very interesting, right? Because I think of the Battle of Pelennor Fields as such a almost like it in some ways encapsulates the despair of Middle Earth in the face of this great enemy, where it's and granted, obviously, it's taking some creative license compared to the books, as you just outlined. But the idea is, you know, Denethor has lost his mind, and he does not care for Faramir nearly as much as he does for Boromir. And part of this is, in the movies, it's a foolhardy errand where it makes no sense, but he is trying to claim some shred of dignity for what he has done in his lifetime as the leader of of Gondor by taking back Osgiliath, which was part of a stronghold for them as a nation. And so sending out his son, obviously he's a fool for doing it. It's not a smart move strategically in the movies, whereas in the books it makes more sense. That being said, it shows a crazy man who doesn't deserve the love of his son, at the same time sending his own son to his death, and his son doing it because he desperately wants the love of his father, right? And he knows that it's for naught, but he's right. Doing it because he wants to show him how much he's willing to sacrifice to get his father's approval. And it's such a despairing scene because you go, this is all for naught. This is for nothing. Like, why would you even try to do this? But from an emotional standpoint, you get the bind that he's put himself in where he goes, this son now goes, I have nothing. I have nothing to live for at this point. If I cannot like stand up with dignity for what my father as the king of, or as the steward of Gondor is asking of me. And that's where you have Gandalf trying to stop him in the movies and going, don't do this. You know, your father loves you and all this. And he goes, I am a descendant of the sons of Numenor. I would gladly give my life for her people, her beauty, you know, all of this stuff. And it's just a desperate last lash out of Gondor before their doom, really. And I think that in some way shows the despair of the situation that they're in. And it just shows the craziness of Denethor as a character. I personally really enjoy that scene from an emotional standpoint. And that's maybe why I'm coming at it this way. I see it's interesting to think about Denethor as a more nuanced character, more or less is where I'm coming from for this. And I appreciate that. It would have been interesting to see that in the movies. And I don't know, maybe going back to your point, is could they have told the same story with this more nuanced view in the way that you just outlined, which is more true to the books?
Yeah, I think that the...
Yeah, probably.
I think they could have. I can understand. Again, I can understand why you want to have these scenes the way they play out, and you get a similar emotional payoff in some ways between Gandalf and Faramir, especially. And you also have like Pippin and Faramir take a ton of Gandalf's lines in this movie. It's very funny.
nice,
but you see this. Denethor doesn't have a redeeming quality in the movie. He has zero redeeming qualities. He's crazy man who sends his son out to die, right. And then he gets sad when his son dies or almost dies, and it's like, right. Oh, boo-hoo, who thought that was gonna happen? Like, it's
that's true
when he sends him to Osgiliath, it's like he will probably die, but this is a noble and necessary thing, and my son, and he thinks my son Boromir could have done it. And then as soon as he sees his son come back, he has deep regret. He is so regretful that that's the last straw. I'm gonna kill myself. That is the end of hope. And that's the thing, is that Denethor paid a price looking into the Palantir all those years. He's that Sauron saw into his mind and saw his fears and saw what he saw, his you know, his ego and his everything that his entire personality was wrapped up in. And now at the end you have, okay, Denethor doesn't redeem himself, which is why it's okay for him to die. He doesn't redeem himself, but he has redeeming qualities. He loves his son Faramir. He did a terrible thing and he kills himself over it. And you have this incredible emotional tension between Faramir and his father, which doesn't matter if he just had a bad dad. If his father was just awful,
right?
Who really cares that much that he died? Nobody. Whereas if his father was a great man who has lost his grip because he's been spending too much time looking into this Palantir, looking outside of his palace walls, and is too wrapped up in Gondor and himself to see... to see what's going on around him, who cares? So you lose this entire thing when you have him just crazy. You do get an old man on fire running off a cliff, though, which is fun to watch. So, like,
I will admit, I like that scene.
That was pretty fun. So
Yeah, that's okay, I see where you're coming from with that. That's very interesting. I think that just from a mindset perspective, especially of time, because if you watch the extended edition, this thing's 4.5 hours long, little excessive in regards to most movies, which are like a third of that. So it's I love all the extra stuff as a fan, but also I understand how you can't have that in a normal movie. Right. You're not going to watch this every weekend type thing. So I don't know that you could keep all the story about the Palantir in the movie, but I do think that it would be interesting to see, okay, Denethor as a character who is more nuanced, who actually has value as a character, who's really trying to do the right thing in most of the circumstances, but he has gone a little crazy, doesn't make all the right decisions, right? And then it makes his loss as a person who dies more valuable. I think you have made a compelling case against Denethor in this story. Okay, now we can get to Eowyn. What are your thoughts on Eowyn? All right.
So Eowyn, again, I'm not, and this one I will admit, it's been a long time since I've seen the Two Towers. Mm-hmm. So she may have more compelling reasons given in that movie than in Return of the King. But the Return of the King, the only moment you get, and again, I understand there's time constraints, there's a lot of characters, you're trying to do a lot of stuff, mm-hmm. even a 4-hour movie, trying to do a lot. So I get that there may be some things that you need to cut. But mm-hmm. when you have a character like Eowyn, who you know is going to be important, because she kills the Witch King. And I can understand even cutting the romance thing between her and Faramir. Like, I appreciate that in the book. It's nice mm-hmm. that you get that payoff, but mm-hmm. I can understand kind of really cutting back on her relationship with Aragorn and really cutting down on the screen time with her and Faramir, but you need to give her a compelling reason to disobey her father and to ride out with Rohirrim. And the only scene I get that in, and you know, maybe I missed something, maybe there's something in the Two Towers that explains a little bit better, but the only scene I get that in is where she talks to Éomer about, I can't remember what she's talking about, but essentially he says, women don't belong on the battlefield, babe. Mm-hmm. And that's it. And then she's like, you know what? Let me show you. I am a boss woman and I will go out there. And that's not a great reason for her to disobey the man that she thinks of as a father, who is literally her king, and ride out into battle to die, mm-hmm. which is her whole thing in the book. It's so in the books, it's so depressing. Every time Eowyn talks, it's like, oh my gosh, what did they do to you? And well, what they did to her is Grima Wormtongue was hanging out with her for like years and whispering mm-hmm. Saruman's words into her mind, and she thought that she was, you know, that the line that Saruman has, which is about the House of Aeol is a house of you know, it's a house low repute. In the books you can have these long conversations between Gandalf explaining everything and the narrator explaining that, like, mm-hmm. she's traumatized from all mm-hmm. these years of essentially abuse at the hands of Greyba Wormtongue, mm-hmm. and she's convinced that she is worthless. And because Aragorn, who is a man of Numenor, who is a high man, who she knows would lift her out of her situation, cannot love her, that's the last straw for her. And she's like, if I cannot have honor in my life, then I may as well die with honor. So that's, you know, the books create a compelling reason. And it's, but the reason the books create for her to go out and do this is long. And it takes a lot of time to pay off. And I can understand why you might like manipulate that in the narrative of the movie to try and make it a little bit shorter, a little more concise to fit the movie. But they just don't do that, as far as I can tell, in The Return of the King. They don't do that. They just have this one scene, and then she runs out to die.
Eowyn as a character is an interesting character to me. Partially because she's, and part of this does go back to what they portray in The Two Towers for her as a character, right? Where she is someone, one, she's not your typical woman. She's not good at cooking. She's more of a person who likes to be out there with the men doing the more more or less manly, quote unquote, things to do. And so when you have these discussions with her, a lot of what she's at is, I am standing more or less before the chaos of the world, and it is, I'm more or less there to embrace it. And when asked about, like, oh, well, what about the womanly duty? She sees that more as a cage, and her life as a limiting factor. And she desires to be free of that. And so you have that built up at the, especially in the Two Towers for who she is as a character. And then you have in this movie, more or less the desire to be with the ones she loves and fight for them, right? And they say, well, that's not your place, you can't do that. And she rejects that and says, well, I'm going to do it anyways. So you have more of a hopeful character for sure in the movies compared to the books. It is interesting to think about how she's more of a despairing character, because she does have that morose personality in both, I believe, both sides. And it was definitely in the movies where she is very sad, right, the entire time, and doesn't really appreciate a lot of what's going on. So I personally, more from a storytelling perspective, especially comparing her, let's just say, to other female protagonists that we've seen in movies today, I find her as a more compelling female protagonist type character than a lot of other characters, partially because she has more of a backstory of, oh, well, I have this desire to, rise out of this situation, and no one says I can, I'm not allowed, yada, yada, but I buck those conventions and do it anyways. And from, like, I'm not necessarily a fan of just having a female protagonist for the sake of having a female protagonist. I don't think that's the case here. Right. But what I am saying is that if you're going to make a female protagonist character, I think this is more of the way to go, where you have someone who has a lot of social norms and constructs around her that say, this is not, you can't do this, this is not the right way to go. And she has these internal struggles of, oh, I love this person. Oh, I want to be with the people I love. Oh, I'm not good at these other things, but I do know that I can fight. And I believe that I can do the right thing in this situation. And the right thing to do is to reject the social norms in this case and fight alongside these other people. I think that that's a far more compelling protagonist than, let's just say, Captain Marvel, who just says, oh, I'm a girl boss and can do what I want. And look at me, I can defeat everyone. So, you know, I think
it says a lot more about how bad female protagonists are now than it does. It does about how great Eowyn is in the movies. But I do.
You might not be wrong.
I appreciate you saying, because I was thinking she might have more of a background in the Two Towers that I just didn't see, because it's been so long since I've watched it. I couldn't remember. But I do appreciate that she does have, there's a little bit more going on there. I'm just going to leave it at, I appreciate that there's more to the story than just the part you see in The Return of the King. And I'm going to leave it at, I think there was a better way to do it, but I don't think that it's going to kill the story, or, like, you know, it's going to not going to be detrimental to the story or the watching experience to change that. So I'm going to just move on from that.
I don't need to
get into the nitty gritty of it with you.
The book is
so much better because this it is, but I'm not gonna do that.
Sure. And I'll try to move us along a little bit more going forward, but especially for the last thing I want to say into her, because, and I'm gonna do this more, usually we try to go more, oh, this is how the arc goes, we're at this point in the arc, what did you think of this, what did you think of that, all that stuff. In this case, I might go more character based just because there's so much going on that it's easier to go through this character's individual arc and close that and then move on. So for the sake of just closing Eowyn's arc, you have at the end where she's fighting the Witch King of Angmar, and you have that epic scene where, you know, he's going to, he killed Theoden with the Nazgul that he's his ride. And then, you know, he goes to fight her, and he goes, no man can kill me. And she says, I am no man, and stabs him in the face. Right. What did you think? Was that good? Was that bad? What did you think in regards to the story?
you know, it's very good. They had Mary stab him in the knee, which is great. Mm-hmm. And the book, I think, is a little bit confusing on that point. And, you know, maybe it's because I was listening to the audiobook this time around when I did it. But I've mm-hmm. always read it as the thing that actually killed the Witch King was Pippin. Mm-hmm. Or not Pippin, Mary, sorry.
Okay.
Because he had an old Blade of the West that was forged for the war against the Witch King of Angmar, which is this guy, the Witch King of Angmar, is the head of the Nazgul.
Right.
And Pippin stabs him, and obviously Eowyn stabs him too.
Right.
But she just uses the Sword of the Rohirrim. So right. I don't know how much of that, like, I don't know who actually kills him in the book, and I don't know who kills him in the movie.
It's
a great scene, though.
Yeah.
It's really fun. Like, it's the part she does cut off. I can't remember the name of the flying beasts. She does cut off that thing's head, though, in the books and in the movies. And it's really fun to watch her do it. And the Witch King gets super pissed off, and he comes out. He's got this ludicrous mace.
Yeah.
And he's got this sword, and he's super tall, and he has this tall helm, and he's just terrifying. You've got the scene with little Eowyn going, getting hit in the shield arm, and her arm's broken. And it's really fun. I think there are especially Peter Jackson can do action. Mm-hmm. Those the moments where you have the epic charge, the moments mm-hmm. where you have the insane fight scenes and the massive scope and the scale, those scenes play the best to me. And mm-hmm. this scene is just really fun. So I enjoyed that scene. It was good.
Okay. Yeah. No, that's like a legendary scene for me, especially like literally it's a ringtone on my phone. I love it so much. So you can say that I liked that scene a lot. Hey guys, hope you guys have appreciated watching. We will be back for a second part for this epic discussion. So hope to see you guys back again in a couple days.